throw your face on the ground. How do you do that?
Like Co. Just take it off.
You just take
like,
it
or
off.
Like,
just...
like Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Took
with
his
John
face
Travolta and face off. Yeah.
Off. Yeah.
You just take it straight off.
Just right off. Hey, I'm taking a page out of your playbook today, and I'm eating some freshly cooked bacon.
Oh, my God. What'd you do? How'd you cook it? Did you bake it? Did you fry it? Did you
I laid down on a cookie sheet. Uh-huh. Laid down the parchment paper.
Yeah.
Spread them out flat.
Yeah.
Thin like paper.
Yeah.
375.
375.
Watch
nah,
it.
Nah.
You gotta
nah,
watch
see,
it by eye. I should be by nah, eye.
See,
can't,
now
no,
see, now nah, you're doing it all wrong. You got to go at least 400.
No, man, that's how you burn them. That's how you...
No, you just
you get
watch
black
them.
Char, dude. You don't want...
No. See, no. Okay, let me tell you something here. First, what kind of grade bacon are you using?
It depends on what I can afford at the time with you know, the weight of the state of this economy.
You gotta,
bacon's
you gotta
a
get,
precious, precious
you gotta
commodity.
Get the black label, okay? You gotta get the black label bacon.
Johnny Walker black bacon, they make it's, it?
Maybe, but you got to get. There's just a black label, okay? I don't know who makes it. You got to get that stuff. You got to get that gourmet bacon.
Only the finest of grease.
Yes, you got to lay it out perfectly, and make sure you lay away from your body. Lay
I
away.
It's like you got like a paper towel bed that you're just like
yes.
laying it down, like
then,
gently on the pillow, you're tucking them in.
What you want to do is take a little bit of brown sugar.
Oh, yeah. Any kind of sugar, kinda, really. Like, if you sprinkle
yeah,
it.
Yeah, or maybe, like, sugar in the raw, even.
Mm, I've never tried sugar in the raw. That'd be interesting.
Just sprinkle just a little bit on top. Pop
it
in the
spritz.
Oven for, like, 400 and just watch. Because
it's going to bubble and it's going to caramelize
yeah.
on top of them strips.
Oh, yeah.
This is just turning into a cooking episode. And I love it.
Maybe, that'd be an interesting thing to do, like a cooking episode. Think of all the pre-pro we would have to do for a cooking episode.
A lot of planning.
Oh, yeah. Like almost as if we thought it out in advance, unlike this entire show, which we
which
never
we
think
have
out
never
in
once. No, we do and we don't.
Yes, we do. We do sometimes. Yeah, sometimes we have to go by our instincts, but
that doesn't always work out so well. But yeah, I did want to talk because I've actually been I've worked in the past and had issue with not getting pre-pro
yeah.
from other and collaborators, and it's can really make you pull your hair out on the day if you don't have it, because you're
yeah.
trying to figure out and you're trying to make this whatever thing as good as possible, and if you don't have the information to do so, it can be very infuriating.
Yeah, and we'll mostly be talking pre-production from a film standpoint, but
you know,
some of
can,
the stuff we'll
can
talk
apply
about
to various things.
Yeah, no, just the concept of pre-production, just planning, whatever you want to, you
yeah.
know, for film, we call it pre-production.
Pre-pro for short.
Pre-pro,
often.
Yes. But it's just that sense of like planning, outlining, organizing. So there's a lot of things in here that
a lot of the time for our show, not to give away our sauce, as it were.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the time you and I just tend to make an outline of bullet points we want to hit. And it's like,
yeah.
it can act like a skeleton to get us,
yeah.
to get our spaghetti monster through this mess of life.
Yes. And it all comes down to two, you got to know how you work as an artist or a creative or anything. Like, doesn't necessarily have to be a creative standpoint, but
yeah.
the more pre-production you do to anything, the easier the actual physical act, the production side will be.
One of the arguments I often hear too is like, oh, that's going to hurt your ability to riff. No, it's not. Not at all.
No.
Actually, the more you plan, the more it's going to help your ability to riff and
yes,
spin and change on the day.
I would agree with that. You know, it's that simple saying of measure twice, cut once.
Exactly.
Type deal. Think twice, act once, if you will.
I was trying
but
to come
yes.
up with, there was a horror thing there. I was like, with cut, measure twice, cut once. I was like, I couldn't get it fast enough. Joke gone.
But yes, so we're talking about the pre-production phase, specifically a film.
Yeah, which I thought about it, and I was like, I wish somebody had like sat me down and explained this before the first time I got on a set.
Yeah.
Like, it would have saved me so many headaches over a long period of time.
Yeah, and just to be clear, there's essentially three agreed upon stages. There's when you go into the actual shooting and making of the film, there's pre-production, production, or principal photography.
Mm-hmm.
And then post-production. We will be talking about stage one.
The thing that I've always had in my head with pre-pro is it's the only phase that, well, it's the most importantly so phase that once you're done, you can't really go back and change it. Like you can't go back and retroactively plan out once you're in it. You know what I mean?
Oh, like once you're in production, you mean?
Yeah, it's an absolute nightmare to try and go back and redo pre-pro.
Okay.
Or try and do pre-pro when you haven't done it in the first place.
Oh yeah. I got you. Okay,
I thought you were saying happen in for a real second time there. And it is not
okay,
pretty.
I was getting confused there for a second. I was like, wait a minute, Brian. Pre-pro is all about like trying to hammer out the details, and if you make a mistake, you correct it. But I understand what you're saying now.
Like once you've left pre-pro and you're on set, and then you're like, oh, I didn't do pre-pro. Like, and then you try, like, I've watched a director sit there and try and do like script lining or script breakdowns, and like while you're shooting the script, you're like, no, you can't do that. That's going to be such a mess because you're trying to your focus.
I mean, obviously you can, but it's not advised, or it's really going to make it. You're adding much.
It's
more
a mistake.
Difficulty to
it's a huge mistake. I've made a huge mistake.
Nobody drink the beer. The beer has gone bad.
But yeah, so in terms of pre-pro, I know it's a lot of people always ask me, it's like, what's the best way to do it? There's a lot of different ways. And, you know, from small budget to big budget, there's a lot of obviously different things that can come into play.
Yeah.
On most of my experience, as long as you have a shot list, some form of script breakdown and overheads, I'm talking specifically from the director DP standpoint, because that's where my largest amount of experience is. But I know it's very important for sound as well. Mm-hmm. For tech scouts to be there so they can iron out, okay, what's going to be a potential issue on the day. I remember thinking back to, we were watching Project Greenlight back in the day. They didn't bring sound on the tech scout, and they were right under an airplane path, and they scouted in a period of time through the day when planes weren't actively flying over, so they didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so you want to try and identify as many of those potential issues as possible before you get out there and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Or if anything, it's trying to make yourself just aware that if you do run into this issue, here are your options to correct it. Essentially how, like they say, you know, you want to shoot, for example, one of a more basic thing you're taught is try to schedule your exterior shots first in your production schedule.
Yeah.
Because if you run into weather, and we all know weather is unpredictable at best.
It's a lot easier to fake an interior shot than it is an exterior.
Yeah, and you can always have like a rain shoot. Just like, okay, we can't get this shot today, so we'll move this to something else, and we'll reschedule this exterior shot for later in the production schedule. Because obviously, if you clump all your exterior shots in the final week, and 4 out of the 7 days it rains, and you can't shoot where you wanted to, well, then you're kind of screwed. You have to, you know, if you're in the studio system, you're going to have to ask for more time and more money.
And a ton then. More money, because it's the bigger the machine, the harder it is to turn the wheels.
Yeah.
So pre-pro, and I say this consistently in terms of any kind of production, pre-pro is God. Like, you have to have pre-pro.
So anybody I had something there. I had like a pun.
Yeah, I could smell
it
in what you're saying. You had something good. But it really is God. If you don't, I've worked with people before who've argued saying, oh no, you don't have to do that. I'm like, it's not just for that one person. It is for everybody else that is working with you to help you as much as possible. To not have it is a bad boo-boo. It does not help anybody to say no. That's just avoiding work, in my opinion.
Oh yeah. No, I would agree. To someone who's like an adamant, like, nope, I don't need pre-production.
Yeah,
I
you guess, don't. It's not for you. It's for everybody else outside of your head.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yes. Because I feel like that was going to be my argument there, playing devil's advocate, was, well, you know, what if you find someone who can do it that way? It's like, great. We're not you. Like, not everyone can do that. And like,
especially
you said,
if you don't have like that long form, you know, shorthand with somebody, if you're working with a new DP or a new director or, you know, some like a new sound guy, like there's going to be like a lack of that shorthand that they're not going to be able to read your mind and jump ahead of you. So they're going to need that list of shots, that list of plan, what's coming next, so that, you know, you can be ahead of the curve without knowing this person to the end.
Yeah, and where does, for you, at least in what you've seen, because you've been on more sets than I have, so you have a better grasp.
Fair,
on
but yeah.
No, I mean, you have. But where does pre-pro start for you? So obviously before that comes the script, and
I get a text being like, hey, I got a project in mind. I'm like, all right, where's my script breakdown? Where's my shot list? Before they even like have like finalized pages.
Yeah.
So I am the pre-pro insane person.
So let's define these terms for people who have never seen it or known it. The shot list. What are we talking about here?
So shot list is, from a director's standpoint, you want to have, you're looking at your script. Let's say, okay, your final draft, you finish the script, or even not even final draft. Like, you're just
For argument's sake, we'll just say that's it. That's the final draft. Yeah. We've locked it. There will be only minor tweaks maybe into the dialogue if someone says something funnier the day of or whatever. But this is the script.
You want to get literally a bullet pointed list of every shot that you want to get in terms of coverage from a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you want that for every scene in your script. You want to, and an ideal way to, the key to this is, you know, just what shot angle you want. Like, say, is it a medium shot? Is it a wide shot? You know, even if, like, that's, you know, it's more complicated than the simple terms we'll cover, just so your on-set people can get a rudimentary understanding where your head's at.
Yeah, and a quick little sidebar there when you were saying, like, medium, wide shot. Just a quick crash course in, like, shot sizes.
Shot language.
Shot language, thank you. And correct me if I'm wrong here, it's been a bit, but pretty much anything full body in the actor or the character is considered a long shot, if you will, a wide shot. And then as anything from like the waist up is considered like a medium shot.
Mm-hmm.
Medium, and then the closer you go in, it's, you know, then you get to the close up, medium close up.
Combine those terms extreme, appropriately as you move in and out.
You know, master shots, wide, you know, like a wide shot, like if you're just doing something.
Every time I hear wide shot, I think of Bill Hader in Tropic Thunder. We're going to get this in a wide shot, right? Shot. Of course we're going to get it in a wide shot.
Essentially, for me, I always understood it, just to simplify it, is the relation of your characters in the image, in the screen, in the frame, to how much of that frame they command. If it's their entire face, if it's just them, that's a close-up. If it's, you know, something of like in Lawrence of Arabia when he's crossing the desert and he's like kind of just this little ant in this vast landscape, that's like a wide shot.
The thing is too, like, these are very arguable terms. Like, there's no like set playbook on this.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it tricky. You kind of got to get into the head of the person you're working with, which is tricky. And that's why pre-pro is so helpful.
Because
it gives you a better, like, it's not going to get you all the way there, but it's going to get you much closer to understanding where their head's at.
Yeah. So for you, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and that brings me back to the numbering system. And like, that is what's helpful in organizing all of this. And it's a lot of the time you'll hear, like, whenever you see like a second AC on behind the scenes footage, like slating, they'll be like, 14B Alpha Baker, whatever, and then they flip it and clap. So that's coming from that. Those numbers are coming from the pre-production materials. That's like identifying where in the pre-pro materials relating to the script, what shot is this. So when they're in editing, it makes it super easy to identify and organize all of it.
Well, yeah, and too, there's a lot of the pre-production that goes through to post-production too.
Yeah, a lot of it channels right through the script supervisor as well. Like, they're pretty much in charge of like keeping all of that straight on the day, which is like, it can get very, I've seen a lot of script supervisors that are like losing their minds on set. So I really do empathize with them because they have a big responsibility to keep all of that straight.
Well, and two, like continuity, I'm assuming, comes into play, well, on set at least.
Oh, big time. Yeah, script supervisors really do have a big responsibility. They're in charge of a lot.
Yeah. And for anyone, like, again, just continuity purposes are simply just, you know, like if you're shooting a scene and I'm just
from two different angles, making sure that, you know, an action or clothing or props, anything is positioned and behaving the same way from one shot to another.
Yeah. You know, like a typical example is like if you're doing like an action movie or something and someone has like a scar on their face or like, you know, they just got punched. And
they get punched and then the scar is on the other side.
Yeah. And then like you got to shoot one scene one day, but then you have to come back like a week later and then reshoot it again or something. That you got to make sure that is adding up, and you will. And it's tough. There are no movie, I don't think, doesn't have some aspect of a little bit of continuity errors going on.
I was watching The Dark Knight the other day. There's a really bad one in The Dark Knight. Well, not really bad, but in the scene where they're in the like new Batcave with mm-hmm. all the computer monitors and stuff, like cutting back and forth between Alfred and Christian Bale, like it's like shot to shot, his Bale's head is down and up and down and up.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like every time I see it, it sticks out to me. But
yeah, I was just saying like that, like the continuity comes into play.
Yeah. It's important because I mean, it can really screw up a day.
So you have your shot list. And do you now, when you're looking at a script, do people still do? I remember we were taught like, okay, you're looking at the script, you draw a line vertically down through the dialogue and the action.
That goes into script lining, or I've also heard it called script breakdowns.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
That's where your shot numbers from the shot list come into play, and they're very important. Typically, like how I number it is like, four, like say you're in the 14th scene of a script, so it would be four, like scene 14.1 or 2 or 3,
yeah.
And that's indicating shot 1 of scene 14.
14, yeah.
And sometimes you'll have an alternate of that, so it could be like 14.1B or 14.1C.
Yeah.
If there's like an alternate version of that with either like, you know, a different version of it for editing purposes, it can mm-hmm. be a number of different things. But
and now I've seen people sometimes too, not even, they'll just go like 14A, 14B.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. Yeah. Commonly. But that's really up to the disposition of whoever did the pre-production.
Yeah. You could arguably call it, I don't know, okay, shot alpha delta or whatever you want to call it, alpha shot. Doesn't matter. As long as
I've
you
seen
know
that commonly
and everyone else
on commercials.
Knows. That's the key. This is almost like the pre-pro is a way to, it's the communication you have to do beforehand so that, like you were saying, to limit it, the confusion that you're inevitably going to have, to mitigate the confusion you're eventually going to have when you're on set.
The big things are it allows shot list, between shot list and script breakdowns, those very important things allow your crew to draft overheads
mm-hmm.
and account for, all right, what shots are going to be got where, and how can we set up A, camera, and B, lighting in the most efficient ways possible to get the maximum amount of coverage in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah, and what is an overhead for those of us who
so it's like
don't know or who have forgotten?
Picture you're looking at a room or the set that is built to look like a room. You're looking at it from the top down.
So almost like the blueprint.
Yes.
Of,
it's, like, it's basically a blueprint, but you have positioned inside of this drawn out blueprint where each actor is going to sit, where their potential moves are, where the camera is going to sit, where its potential moves are, and where lighting is going to sit. And in rare, but getting more and more common these days cases, where the lighting may move in throughout the scene, which I've seen sets that do that more and more. We were talking to Cody on the Gaffer episode, and he was talking about how a lot of the times they'll have them rigged on high rise and they'll lift and lower for mm-hmm. different things. So that's now a factor. But yeah, that's just to keep all, because that stuff can get very chaotic very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Or you can keep that organized, and with all those pre-pro materials, better off you're going to be.
Well, yeah. And I was just saying, like, when you're on a set too, and you have, like, you know, tons of equipment, tons of money in their price, how expensive they are, you certainly don't want to break them. Also, too, you also want to make sure that everyone's safe.
Yeah,
and
you all,
no
even
one's tripping or anything like that.
The bigger scale you get with that, the more money is in play, and the faster you can go with all this, the mm-hmm. cheaper the day is going to be, the happier you're going to make your superiors, because the cheaper you can make the day, it's better for everybody.
Yeah,
big time. But also, you know, that goes into play. I mean, money is a factor with everybody, and that goes big time into play with smaller budget stuff. I mean, most of the sets that I have been on have been very low budget, and you mm-hmm. want to keep things as cheap as possible, because that's going to stretch every dollar that you have to make the project as good as it possibly can be.
Yeah. And it's not, there's nothing like, we're not touching on anything revolutionary in terms of the pre-production process. Like, you think of it in other things in daily life or other organizations and professions, you know, you gotta, if you're going to be doing a stage play or a musical, you have rehearsal, you practice, you learn your lines. If you're an athlete, you go and you practice. For football, you learn the plays. Baseball, you take time in the batting cages or run the drills. So there's nothing, this is essentially the practice for the film you're about to shoot, essentially, is trying to figure out what's going to work, what's not, what issues we're going to run into as we get onto it.
But yeah, we were talking about script breakdowns, and as you draw with the line down the page, like, it's, you can most easily do this if you print out a copy of the script, go in with a pen, then you can rescan it if you need to send it.
And I don't know, but I'm sure you can find script breakdowns on the internet. Maybe we can attach match one.
I think Final Draft will let you do this in it, yeah. But I'm not 100% sure.
Just to give a better idea of what we're talking about. But if you're looking at a script.
But like, yeah, you take a, I typically will take a printed out copy of the script and literally like draw brackets down center, left of page, right of page of the script. And those will indicate, like, so you write the shot number over it, and then the line will indicate over what period of dialogue that shot will take place. So then you can look at that and identify and like literally break down the script in terms of what coverage you're planning to get.
Yeah.
And it's I think that in coupling with overheads and a shot list, those three things are the most important. If you can have those three things, you can have an efficiently run set.
It's strange too how like, because you know, this is, what is it, the left brain? What's the right brain, the left brain, whatever, the opposite. This is the logistical side of making art or film in particular here. This is where that, okay, I got a plus B equals C type deal here. I have to have this many shots on this day. It's going to cost me X amount of money. I need this many people. We're going to need this many hours to do it. So this is where you have to flex the other side of your mental capacity.
And honest to God, this is what I live for. Like I love pre-pro to death. Like he
loves pre-pro, ladies and gentlemen. He loves pre-pro.
We've talked before about how I love to dive into lore and stuff. I'm just as like my eyes light up just as much when I find out I get to do pre-pro.
It's almost like
it's like Christmas morning.
It's almost like the accounting side of the project. Not quite. But like you're dealing with the cerebral work here is
well
is
it's like
happening.
I do get excited about like saving myself headaches. So if it is a project that I'm like working, it's like, oh, I can head these X amount of problems off right off the bat. I know exactly how to like all I need is like a quick look at the location, be like, all right, I can do this and just save. I'm like, I look at it as like I'm saving myself future headaches and like how I get to kind of like think about how good the thing is going to end up looking. So it's like I'm also like hyping myself up and getting excited.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But yeah, I think that everybody should take a note from pre-production if you plan on getting into a creative project, because I think it's so important. The other big thing, and this gets into some bigger scale productions, because it's not always the case that this is an achievable thing, especially like in lower budget stuff when you're getting a location on a favor or someone's goodwill, and it's like not a place that you could ordinarily just walk into. But a tech scout is very important. I actually, a buddy of mine works in locations for stuff in Cleveland, and he has a blast. He sends me some stuff here and there, and he gets to like go in and like he will break down the location for like all these different logistical things for sound, light. I know he goes out and runs the Helios app. Have you heard of this?
I have heard of it. You've told me about it before, but I'm not versed in it at all.
Yeah, so like there's all different kinds of things now. I still like Helios, but it's an app that will show you the course of like good gaffers, good DPs like can know that off the top of their head. I often can see it, but I like to have it reassured in my head that I have it right. Mm-hmm. You can see where the course of the sun is going to occur through the day. So then you can basically plot out where and how light is going to hit through a location and through the windows, like specifically daylight. If you can check a location for both day and night, because then you can see like how street lamps are going to hit, how, you know, other properties light is going to hit and stream. The better you can interpret all that and understand what you're working with, the basic canvas that you're working with in terms of a location, the better off you're going to be, because then the fewer variables are going to be thrown at you out of left field. But yeah, Helios app is a great thing to have in your arsenal, because it's literally you can keep it on your phone, just check the plotting of the sun through the day. Now that'll change over the time through the months, but like as long as you're checking a location in relative succession to when you're going to be shooting.
And does that have a big learning curve, or is it pretty?
It's pretty easy.
Pretty easy to use.
Yeah, it's such a great tool. I saved my butt so many times in just checking a location, being like, all right, this is then I can confidently predict how the sun is going to react to a location, and like as long as like weather isn't a factor, I know exactly what I'm working with and how something's going to look.
Yeah,
and how I can augment my artificial lighting to supplement or detract from that, and you know what the ball game is I'm working on. Another big thing that you want to look for when you're on a tech scout, I mean, say it's getting more and more common now that they're more and more affordable, is drone work. If you're flying a drone, you have to know what the wind conditions are going to be, and that goes into checking the weather, knowing like ahead of time like what your weather conditions are going to be, because if it's going to be a particularly windy, stormy, whatever kind of day, you got to account and know for that you either can't or are going to have a tough time with using a drone, or it's going to affect your lighting. There's all kinds of factors that the weather can get in the way of.
Yeah. Also, too, you got to look out for, like, there's a lot of ordinances out there now that don't allow drone flying in certain areas without prior clearance. So that's always a thing you got to look out to.
Also, too, and anybody who's flying knows a lot of this stuff now, but I mean, a lot of places will not let you fly without a license. If there is, and here in Pittsburgh, if there's a football game going on, it changes everything. Because that's all, you know, the Steelers are the only thing that's important.
Yes.
But yeah, in most cases, you have to have an FAA license now to fly. So,
which I have no, now where does that come in? Like, how do you even attain that?
It's, you can take, there's a test you can pay to take and have it. It's a little piece of paper.
Yeah.
It's doable, but you know, you do have to study for it. Know what you get. Like, but like I said, anybody who's getting into that and has some experience flying knows what they're getting into with that anyway. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like we said before, it's important for sound as well. The potential for setups, how lighting, how your camera, and how sound are going to rig are all things you want to look out for in a tech scout. You know, how there's all kinds of different things like the pressure rigs and stuff, those long pipes that can extend, like anywhere you can squeeze those in. And on a tight, like low budget set, those things are huge in like saving yourself time because you can rig up a bunch of lights, boom, in the ceiling. You're not having to drill into the ceiling. You're not having And it's like, can something like that work? You want to jot as much of that stuff down as possible because that's all going to be so important to all these different crews.
Yeah.
And the more that, on top of all of that, the more these crews can like communicate with each other, know how to not get in each other's way on the day. Like,
well, yeah. And two, you think, and not just from like a script breakdown point, not just from a lighting and the camera and the shot setup, but you're also looking at what you need prop wise, special effects, visual effects.
Yeah.
The actors.
Visual effects too, like the
wardrobe, stuff like that.
I've worked sets before where they'll run in with the mirror ball. They'll go in and record those, just have all that information. They're already ready to go.
Yeah.
Also, like you want to look at when you're doing a tech scout, if you can look out for spots for hair and makeup to set up where they can fit into the equation.
It's another one I always tend to forget too, but it's a big one, is hair and makeup. Like sometimes that can take hours depending on what you're doing.
Yeah. You have to allot time for that. You know, once your actors are getting called to set, they're on the clock in the makeup chair. So, you know, you got to account for that. And, you know, you also have to account for where, like we were saying on the tech scout, like where are they going to set up? They have to have a spot. And, you know, cast a lot of time with costume changes, they have to have a place to be able to change privately that they're away from everybody. And that's not always an easy thing to do with remote locations. Sometimes you have to bring in trailers and give them a place to do that. So those are all factors. I remember I was working a feature and we had hair and makeup literally floating around the set because we were shooting out the entire house. So they never had a permanent setup. They constantly had to be moving around. So we realized we didn't have a good plan for that. And that was one of the things we went back, we're like, we should have had an exterior spot for them.
Well, and yeah, and then you tend to have your staging areas, you have your actual set.
Yeah, like you got to know where your equipment's going to go.
Yeah.
The crew can access it, then be out of the way.
Also, too, where you're going to shoot, you got to know, where can we park? Are we allowed to park there? How far is parking from the actual set itself? And do we have to lug the equipment like uphill or something?
Well, also like company moves, if you're planning on shooting out multiple locations in a day, like, you know, you have to allot time for being able to load equipment, move, set back up, like get going. Like it's all that stuff takes time and you have to account for it. And also potential issues. As soon as you do a company move, you have to like, oh, my DP got pulled over and got a ticket. Like, that's your time. Like stuff like that happens.
I remember back in college during our P3 shoot, we were driving out into like the middle of the state east-wise.
Yeah.
And I ended up the tire in my car ended up just busting.
What shoot was this? I think I might have actually been on this. Or at least you told me the story so well.
That was on the Shepherd and the Bodock shoot.
Okay.
We were driving out, I think, to Derry, PA or something.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where exactly I got, but yeah, like the whole tire just went. Yeah, so we had to, I mean, we were able to make it work. Someone had to come back, pick up who was super important and go. And then I stayed and waited for AAA to come.
Yeah. And then, you know, everybody's waiting on you and you're already stressed out about the car.
Yep.
Not fun. But yeah, in addition to all that, like tech scouts are a big deal. Like there's a ton of information to pull from that. It can often, you know, be a very daunting task. People who have that together and straightened out, I respect the hell out of them because there's so many different factors to like look out for.
And if you just were to like sum up a tech scout and like their main job is what?
just to assess a location for its factors and potential issues on a shoot day.
Okay.
And that's a tall order to try and understand all that.
That's not to trivialize it. That's just to sort of simplify
put it
what
in a bottle
the job
of
is.
Explainability. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough work. And guys who do that regularly, that's, you know, I give them a lot of credit. It's tough. In addition to, we've talked, you know, shot lists, we've talked script breakdowns. We haven't talked storyboards.
Yeah. Let's talk storyboards.
Storyboards are tough because not everybody can draw.
No, I cannot draw to save my life.
A lot of the time I've gotten storyboards that are stick figures. Uh-huh. And like very, again, I think about Not Another Teen Movie where Chris Evans walks up and she's painting it, but it's stick figures. Yeah. And he holds the serious face.
You've captured your eyes or something. You have the same eyes or something.
You have
like
your mother's
that.
Eyes.
You have your mother's eyes. Yes, that's it.
I think about that scene every time I get mm-hmm. the stick figures. But yeah, like we were talking with the Titanic episode about how Cameron just has an amazing artistic ability.
Yeah.
And like, if you have a director who can like fully like show you their intended composition, that really is worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
And by that same token, for more robust shoots that have the ability to do it, it's a tough thing. I've seen it on a couple small budget things, but like very rarely. You can get pre-visualization, which is like basically a like low quality rendering of like how a shot will look in CG.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what the point of it is to like, if it's a complex dynamic, like say it's like a long stretch oneer, like where the camera doesn't cut and they're like covering a lot of ground, let's say a steady cam, just like you can express to like the crews, like how this needs to navigate and like what needs to be out of the way, where, how things are going to be lit. Like there's like a lot of crazy complex factors that a storyboard isn't going to convey.
It
previs can be like a big deal.
Yeah, I'd say one thing that the previs gets or helps show better than a drawn storyboard is that sense of motion, that movement that you're going to get. Like if you do a whip pan in the shot, and all that is literally just the camera, it's on a tripod, and you just literally turn it real quick to like the right or all the way around, whatever. But you do like a tilt.
Or if you're on like a CGI hybridized production, like say Avatar, Marvel, what have you, where you can't literally see what's going on, previs mm-hmm. becomes like almost imperative.
Yeah.
I've seen some things with like the volume stage too. Like that stuff gets all so complicated that it's can be very helpful to like explain what the hell's going on to like the rest uh-huh. of the crews yeah. and the cast. Like that stuff can be very important. But like storyboards, like I've seen like people have all kinds of like hip books and stuff that they can just pull out and draw them really quickly, because like, as you know, shots can change, you have to be ready to be able to spin on a dime,
yeah,
as it were. And there's all kinds of helpful tools out there for like people who, like, I know the Academy actually has like their brand of storyboard pages, and it's like a nice little thing that sits on the desk and you can like just sketch them out really quick, and then like the idea is that you can just like paste them into the full book of storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you can draw them out in like a handful and then like put them in whatever order into the book as you need. So there's a lot of cool tools like that.
And if you can't draw like me,
stick figures.
Stick figures, like, do you think, like,
I don't know,
I always honestly, you want to know what I did as a as sort of a compromise? I would use like Legos.
You cut the celebrities out of People magazine.
No, I would use like Legos, and I would set up the shot with the Legos and just take a picture and be like, okay, it's gonna look something like this.
Yeah, well, that's the, I actually didn't include that on the list, but they showed us a bunch of that school, like, you know, just setting us like just to give like the shot compositions and like what is intended.
Yeah.
Like you can shoot them, like say it doesn't even have to be like the same looking location, but just so you can get like the shot languages even.
Yeah,
and understand,
exactly.
Like what you're going for from that.
And I mean, like, if you have a phone today, you have a camera with you. So
yeah.
That I'm just saying that's an alternative to, that's what I learned. You know, if you can somehow use what you have just to get closer to the vision, the image you want to be up on screen, all the better.
And by the same token of previs, I think the two like indications of a big budget production are if you have previs and if you have concept art.
if you have concept art, yeah,
you know that a production is pretty incredibly robust.
Yeah, and not everyone can have concept art because there isn't, you know, you don't have the ability to pay for it, like smaller productions,
yeah.
Short films.
Concept artists are you know, they earn their money. They put in some hard work. But I was thinking about it. Like we've actually, sidebar, I was thinking we could do a whole episode just on concept.
Oh, yeah, you could. Yeah, absolutely.
I was actually thinking of guesting in my friend Jordan for that.
Okay.
Because he's trying to become a concept.
Hey, all right.
But neither here nor there. Concept art can... I literally own books full of concept art just for the sake of trying to
books
make
is
myself,
an understatement.
Yes. Like just trying to make my artistic ability better so I can quickly sketch on the day and try and get somebody to understand what's in mm-hmm. my stupid head.
Yeah, and that's what's tough too is, you know, what you see in your head, you see it. You've got it.
But then explaining that to somebody
else,
that,
translating that to someone else can be not as easy as it sounds.
Which is essentially, like, that's all of pre-pro, honestly, for me, is like just getting what's in the head of the person making the project into the articulate ability of the crew.
Yeah, and here's a funny little concept from just like novel writing. If you're writing like a story, it's called like the pyramid of abstraction. You have more abstract terms up at the top of the pyramid, so things like love or war, you know, things that aren't as concrete. If you have like a concrete thing, it's something that more that you can point to, like a lamp, a desk, a chair. However, one thing to keep in mind too is that going with that whole like translation of getting your vision out to someone else to so that they can make it happen is if you say the example that they give in the pyramid of abstraction is a dog. So if I say think of a dog, guarantee you and I are probably going to think of two different dogs.
Yeah.
And it's going to be vastly different. So if you want to make that even more concrete, make that vision better, you got to say a black German shepherd. Chihuahua mix with half a tail or something. I don't know. You know, now you're both kind of looking at the same image.
Yeah.
So that's just something to keep in mind that I love that comes more from the novel writing world. But two, you can do it in film with making sure that what you're explaining is as concrete as you can make it so that everyone knows what the image, the shot is going to be that day.
Yeah. And it makes everything as easy as possible is the key there.
Yeah.
So that you're not spending time on the day arguing and trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Although sometimes you will probably spend
the day
arguing.
That's still going to happen, but the idea is to limit it as much as possible.
The mitigation process is what pre-pro is meant for.
The other side of the coin are like crew members who don't read the pre-pro that's provided.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Which can also be a factor as well.
I don't read the script. Script reads me.
Nothing is more important than pre-pro. I can't say that enough. I'm just going to keep saying it for the last 10 minutes of this. Pre-pro is very important.
Well, yeah. And so I'll spin it off a little bit, take it into the literature world here.
Yeah.
One of the big arguments when you're looking at writers is, are you a planner or a pantser? Are you a architect or a gardener? Yeah, man. No, like writing, you know, flying by like the seat of your pants. Pantser.
Gotcha.
Is... Anyway. Cut that. But it's just a way of like, do you prefer to outline your story a lot? So some writers will, the agreed upon or the reputable thing is to come out with a book a year. If you're like a big time professional writer.
Ooh, big time author, man, coming out with a book a year.
No, I'm just saying, not me. You kidding me?
I'm just saying
like that's what the industry demands usually. 2 years maybe. But whatever,
yeah.
Doesn't matter. Point being is like, if we break it down into a year, there are some people who will take like 8 months just outlining their stories, doing tons of pre-pro. And then they will then just do a fever-induced writing session for the last 3 months of the year, actually write out the draft. But one of the things that if that works, that's what they do. They have less mistakes than they have to correct in the actual written draft.
And you're not having to go through multiple revisions.
Yeah. You don't have to go nearly as multiple revisions as a gardener or a pantser would do. And that's someone who just hates outlining and just kind of goes, writes as they go. Because for them, outlining is that discovery process. Discovery writing, there's the other one. There's the more pertinent term. Discovery writing is that sense of literally discovering the story. Even you don't know it yet. So you're kind of telling it to yourself. And for writers who enjoy that process more, they don't like the outline because if they outline too much, then they've already told themselves the story and they sort of lose that energy for it, that passion to want to tell it. So that's one thing you have to learn is like where you fall. But I fall on the side of outlining more and that pre-pro production and knowing what scene I'm going to have, what characters are in the scene. I have, okay, I need to accomplish A, B, and C in this scene. So for me then, when I get to that, when it's time to write, I don't have to worry about the big broad strokes of what's going to happen in the story. It's just, all right, character A needs to kill character B, whatever, in this scene. And they need to do it in a way that ties back to the theme. We'll just say that.
A way that's undetectable by the cops.
Yeah, undetectable. But then, like, okay, I don't have to worry about what the characters want, what the conflict of the scene is. All that's been done for me. Now I can focus on making the scene great and focusing on how I'm going to tell it, what words, you know, the sentence structure, the grammar, the paragraph breaks. I can work on the smaller details now rather than those bigger broad strokes from before. Because if you're trying to do that all at once, at least for me, I don't have the mental capacity to sift through all that at once.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing is all in terms of all pre-pro, like this the scale of production is just a mentally insurmountable amount of things. You just can't wrap your head around all of it, which is why having a plan like exactly like in Tremors, you got to be like Earl Bassett and Valentine McKee. You got to have a plan. That's partly why I love that movie, because planning is the central theme. But yeah, pre-pro is God, and I can't say that enough. You have to have a plan going into anything, and something that's as massive a scale, and even the smallest film production is a lot. Like, even if it's just a few pages, it's a lot to wrap your head around, and the more you can have a structured plan for how you are intending to attack it, the better a chance you have at achieving that said idea.
Yeah. No, agreed.
Yeah, the one thing I would say is that nothing just happens. Like, happy accidents can happen, but it's better to just assume that nothing is going to happen by accident, and if you didn't come up with a plan for it, it isn't going to happen.
Uh-huh.
That's a safe assumption for pre-pro, I would say.
Yeah.
Like, just go in knowing that if you don't have it on the page, if you haven't written it down, it ain't going to happen.
Well, and that's something I think, you know, just actually writing something down physically, there is like a sense of, I don't want to use the word catharsis, that's not what I'm looking for, but an act of contrition, or like it becomes real now. It's no longer, you just get it out of your head and that makes it that more real. Even if you just say,
it's even a tangible, when you just thing make as opposed tangible, to something
thank
in
you.
Your brain.
You've actually created something now, even if it's just a to-do list or a shopping list.
Yeah.
I still prefer, and I'm more old school, I still prefer to write things down first.
Oh, we've said before, I like the combination of the two. I like the efficiency and ease of use with digital notes, but they don't. I don't retain anything when I write them.
Yeah.
But they're very value. They have a different kind of value. When I write things down, I always transfer it digitally and vice versa. Like if I only have my phone on me, I can write things down in a quick digital note. I'll go home and write it down. But like also too, like I've started carrying, like they're not the official brand field notes, but I carry a little field notes book with me pretty much everywhere because I like the ability to write something down.
And maybe that's just more of a generational thing. I don't know how someone younger than us would feel about that. Maybe the digital thing still works for them too. Better. That's fine. I think just, but though, getting it out of your brain and onto something, some sort of medium, be it digital, written, rent a plane and paint it in the sky. I don't care.
Chuck a bottle out with a piece of paper in it.
Yeah. Actually doing that, you've started the process now of getting it out of your head and making it something tangible, like you said.
As soon as you start writing notes down on paper, then you have become a writer.
It's like, it doesn't matter how good a camera you got, how much marketing you've done.
Now you're getting into the what is it, Rocky IV? It don't matter how hard you get hit. How hard you get hit. Don't matter how hard you hit. As long as you can get hit.
Keep on coming. Cut me, Mick. Come on, cut me. Come on, Mick. Okay.
Yeah, have a plan. Earl Bassett, go in with a plan and you will come out the better for it. If you go in with a structured plan and know what you want, I guarantee your film will come out with some kind of value.
Yeah.
As long as you can get
it. Keep on coming. Cut me, Mick. Come on, cut me.